And as Yasmin pointed out, at the breakfast, current-day political leaders were asked to reflect on their favorite quotation from Dr. King. Both Governor Baker and Senator Elizabeth Warren alluded to a 1967 speech that King gave about the Vietnam War, and how, even though his advisors had cautioned him against speaking in opposition to the war, Dr. King would not be silent. So let's listen to a portion of that speech. Here's King himself.
A time comes when silence is betrayal. That time has come for us in relation to Vietnam. The truth of these words is beyond doubt, but the mission to which they call us is a most difficult one. Even when pressed by the demands of inner truth, men do not easily assume the task of opposing their government's policy, especially in time of war. Nor does the human spirit move without great difficulty against all the apathy of conformist thought within one's own bosom and in the surrounding world. Moreover, when the issues at hand seem as perplexing as they often do, in the case of this dreadful conflict, we are always on the verge of being mesmerized by uncertainty. But we must move on.
Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. giving his speech, Beyond Vietnam, A Time to Break the Silence. He gave that speech at Riverside Church in New York City on April 4th, 1967, exactly 1 year before his assassination. Now you hear King, the spiritual leader, in that excerpt. But you also hear King, the political philosopher. And that part of Dr. King's legacy is one that we don't hear enough about, according to our next guests. Tommy Shelby and Brandon Terry are professors of African and African-American studies at Harvard. They're also co-editor of the upcoming book, To Shape a New World, Essays on the Political Philosophy of Martin Luther King Jr. And they join me now in the studios. Professor Shelby and Professor Terry, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
So, Dr. King, the political philosopher, tell me more about that. Why did you write this book?
Well, I think we were moved by the sense that this is a underappreciated systematic thinker, a serious political philosopher, who is often mainly understood through famous quotes, praise for his bravery and activism, but really rarely studied in a careful way, rarely studied in our classrooms apart from familiar things like the letter from a Birmingham jail.
Yeah.
Though this is a figure who, you know, wrote some 5 books and numerous essays, and we thought it would be important to encourage not only our students, but also the general reader to go back and study those books.
Right. So, I mean, if you were to have to put it in a nutshell, which I guess I'm about to ask you to, I mean, how would you describe what King's political philosophy was?
Well, I think in many respects, King espouses a kind of radical egalitarianism.
Yeah.
He's dramatically interested in the problem of a society that at its basic structure is unfair to its most disadvantaged citizens. And he's especially concerned with what my colleague Professor Shelby has called the ethics of the oppressed. What kind of responses are justified? What kind of responses are meaningful or beneficial to that kind of oppression when they're undertaken by the oppressed? He really saw everyone as a possible political actor and tried to theorize ways that the least well-off could participate in politics, change the world, claim their own self-respect and dignity, and win broader allies.
Mm. Well, there is a speech that you highlight in your book that I think gets straight to this point, and it's the Other America speech that Dr. King gave at Stanford University in 1967, and it's a It's a remarkable speech. I have to say, I hadn't read through the whole thing until today. And as I read through it, I was stunned. I was astonished by the clarity of his vision regarding economic justice, which we know, I mean, we know in a certain sense was there, right? Because the March on Washington was the march for jobs and freedom, right? And of course, when he was assassinated in Memphis, he was there on behalf of sanitation workers, et cetera. Right. But the clarity with which you hear him speak about economic inequality and the desire for equality at the Other America speech is amazing. So I'm going to stop talking. We'll let Dr. King speak. Here he is. This is an excerpt of this speech he gave at Stanford University.
It's more difficult today because we are struggling now for genuine equality. And it's much easier to integrate a lunch counter than it is to guarantee a livable income and a good solid job. It's much easier to guarantee the right to vote than it is to guarantee the right to live in sanitary, decent housing conditions. It is much easier to integrate a public park than it is to make genuine, quality, integrated education a reality.
Now, I find this to be exceptional because the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act were only recently passed. And here he is saying that was the easy stuff. It's remarkable to even say it out loud. Tell us about the context, the background to this speech.
Sure. I mean, I think that you have to keep in mind that for a long time, King is thinking about the connection between racial injustice and economic injustice. That's in his first book. It's Strive Toward Freedom, about the Montgomery story. But I think he thought of himself as engaged and his colleagues engaged in a long-term struggle that would have two phases. As a phase that's focused on anti-discrimination, bringing down Jim Crow. It's largely a Southern campaign. But I think he thought it was important to turn toward the North, toward the poverty you see in urban neighborhoods, which he calls ghettos, and focus on the economic constraints that people are facing in those environments. And that was the next phase, the second phase of that campaign.
You know, he talks about in the speech about the horrific hypocrisy, right, of American history and American present, because, of course, the economic prosperity of the country was built on the backs of black enslavement. Right. And he talks about how Frederick Douglass said that without true economic freedom, there would be no the totality of it's famine, not freedom, really. He quotes Douglass in this speech.
Right. And King is part of a long tradition in African-American political thought. One of the things we try to highlight in the book is his drawing upon figures like W.E.B. Du Bois or Frederick Douglass and in his debates with black nationalists to give a much richer picture of the kind of contestation that's going on among African-American thinkers. One of the unique contributions that King makes to this tradition is that his indictment of ghetto poverty, his attempt to secure economic justice, really does two things that I think are fascinating. One is that he tries to put democratic politics right at the heart of that problem. So things that we don't usually think of as solutions to the problem of ghetto poverty, he wants to have tenants unions, right? He wants to have welfare rights unions, people organizing and contesting policies even in the bureaucracy and even against private businesses, Operation Breadbasket boycotts. And then he also, you know, really advocates for constitutional change, you know, guaranteed basic minimum income or guaranteed employment, things like that, that would secure the basic dignity of persons on an economic level.
So I want to jump in there because you heard the professor right. In 1967, Martin Luther King called for a universal basic income. And we have a portion of the speech here. Again, this is from the Other America speech that Dr. King gave at Stanford in 1967. And he basically, leading up to this part, he says, you know, someone had been talking about, why don't you, you know, help African Americans pull themselves up by their own bootstraps, and the impossibility of that if, you know, okay, metaphorically speaking again, the community has no bootstraps because they've been so deliberately impoverished for centuries.
It seems to me that the civil rights movement must now begin to organize for the guaranteed annual income, begin to organize people all over our country and mobilize forces so that we can bring to the attention of our nation this need and this something which I believe will go a long, long way toward dealing with the Negro's economic problem and the economic problem with many other poor people confronting our nation.
This is a very specific, as you said, policy prescription for a deep and insidious problem. I mean, how was something like that received amongst other civil rights leaders and, of course, you know, by the nation as a whole?
Well, this is something, of course, people debate, right? I mean, if you think that it's impossible to make use of your various formal freedoms if you don't have adequate means to take advantage of them, what does it mean to be able to move wherever you want to go because there's no discrimination if you don't have any means to afford a decent housing and so on? So, but it's against the background of a dynamic economy where sometimes it's possible for there to be employment for everyone that will meet their various needs, but sometimes because of automation or movement of jobs overseas and so on, there might be a lot of people unemployed who can't find decent work for themselves. And so I think the idea is to make sure that they have a guaranteed floor so that no one is dropping below a decent material well-being in the richest society in the world.
I suppose the sad part to that story is that we haven't reached that goal yet by any means. And it just makes me wonder, why do you think that these aspects of King's thinking, of his philosophy, of what, you know, these major parts of what his overall message was, seem to, I don't want to say have been lost, but they've never really received the same amount of attention that his spiritual leadership did, that his, you know, the dream that he put forth on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial did. Why do you think that is?
Well, the major reason, I think, is because we have a very strong anti-egalitarian force in this country. It's led by the Republican Party, but it's much deeper than that. One of the things that King called for in his broader revaluation of values was his sense that our moral philosophy and our sense of how a society should be organized economically was based on a mistake, right? That we were still organizing those kinds of precepts thinking that we live in a time of scarcity and we live in a time of abundance and affluence in many respects, and that whatever else needs to be worked out, I mean, these are complicated questions, of course, that shouldn't be the presupposition we start with, is that we don't have enough, right? And for him, the fact that we kept returning to those justifications was itself a kind of cruelty, mm-hmm. right? So there's a kind of cruelty in having such affluence and denying even basic minimum dignity to our co-citizens, watching as they suffer and struggle under impossible circumstances.
Yeah. Well, there's one more. There's just one more aspect or piece of writing, I should say. I was going to call it a speech, but it's not a piece of writing that Dr. King penned. And of course, this is from 1963. It's his letter from Birmingham jail. And the reason why I want to bring it up is because you mentioned earlier that there's a radicalism in King, and I think one of the places it's most clearly expressed is in this letter. Right? He's in solitary confinement. He'd been arrested for allegedly breaking Alabama's ban against mass protests, et cetera. And a group of white church leaders put an ad in the newspaper criticizing him for an untimely effort on his part. So the letter from Birmingham jail, searing indictment of that. And I was wondering if you could just read a little excerpt of it for us, because he really goes after what he calls the white moderate.
But the white moderate, who is more devoted to order than to justice, who prefers a negative peace, which is the absence of tension, to a positive peace, which is the presence of justice, who constantly says, I agree with you in the goal you seek, but I cannot agree with your methods of direct action, who paternalistically believes he can set the timetable for another man's freedom, who lives by a mythical concept of time, and who constantly advises the Negro to wait for a more convenient season.
Why is it important that King so clearly wrote this criticism of moderates, who one would think he would want to keep as part of the larger group of supporters of civil rights?
Well, I think it's, of course, he's concerned about the white nationalists and the hardcore racists, but I think that some people are in some ways sincerely committed to equality and racial equality. But it costs things to bring that about. It can cost a lot, and people are much more reluctant to give that up, give up those ill-gotten gains, if you like, in order to really create what he would call sort of concrete freedom, right, rather than merely abstract freedom. And I think he needed to put pressure on people who have a belief that somehow if you just wait long enough that things will work themselves out. Mm-hmm. And he thought it was extremely important to think about justice as something that is demanded for us right now.
Yeah.
The injustice is something that we do and is something we can undo.
Well, so this is an interesting sort of counterpoint to, of course, the famous line that he borrowed from Theodore Parker about the arc of the moral universe bends towards justice. But it's not an infinite bend, right? I mean, here in this letter, he somewhat advocates for creating a situation non-violently, but one in which people feel compelled to act, right, to respond to justice.
Right. It's not automatic.
Right.
You know, again, one of the amazing things about him and is a stark contrast to a lot of how we think about politics in the present is that he really believed that the oppressed could move that arc themselves, right, that the poorest and working class black folks in the South could topple a impenetrable regime of domination and bring it to its knees. He believed in that. And, you know, he constantly exhorting, there's a great passage in Stride Toward Freedom where he talks about he's giving the speech at the mass meeting launching the Montgomery bus boycott. And he's thinking, how can I convince people that their dignity is at stake when they act? Right, that this is the only way that we can change these things and that our dignity is at stake. It's not something that'll happen behind your back. You have to seize the time.
Yeah. Well, the new book is To Shape a New World, Essays on the Political Philosophy of Martin Luther King Jr. It's co-edited by Professor Tommy Shelby and Professor Brandon Terry. They are at Harvard University. They are professors of African and African-American history, I should say, at Harvard University. Remarkable book. It's forthcoming. I really encourage you to pick it up. Professor Shelby and Professor Terry, thank you so very much for coming in today.
Thanks for having us.
Well, we were talking about Dr. King's letter from Birmingham jail. It was first published on April 16th, 1963. And by the way, Dr. King had to write it on pieces of paper that were smuggled into him in the jail because he was held in solitary confinement. And again, it's not a speech, but an open letter. However, later on, King did read the text of that letter, and a recording of that reading is housed at Stanford University's Martin Luther King Jr. Research and Education Institute. Now, I want to play a portion of it. It's about 3 minutes long, and I do have to issue a warning. There is one moment about halfway in where Dr. King utters the N-word. Now, why he does that becomes readily apparent, because King, in this section of the letter, is meticulously going through the litany of injustices experienced by African Americans every single day, and why, in the face of these injustices, civil rights activists could and should no longer wait for justice.
Perhaps it is easy for those who have never felt the sting dots of segregation to say, wait. But when you have seen vicious mobs lynch your mothers and fathers at will and drown your sisters and brothers at whim, when you have seen hate-filled policemen curse, kick, and even kill your black brothers and sisters, when you see the vast majority of your 20 million Negro brothers smothering in an airtight cage of poverty in the midst of an affluent society, when you suddenly find your tongue twisted and your speech stammering as you seek to explain to your six-year-old daughter why she can't go to the public amusement park that has just been advertised on television and see tears welling up in her eyes when she is told that Funtown is closed to colored children, and see ominous clouds of inferiority beginning to form in her little mental sky, and see her beginning to distort her personality by developing an unconscious bitterness toward white people. When you have to concoct an answer for a five-year-old son who is asking, Daddy, why do white people treat colored people so mean? When you take a cross-country drive and find it necessary to sleep night after night in the uncomfortable corners of your automobile because no motel will accept you, when you are humiliated day in and day out by nagging signs reading white and colored, and your first name becomes nigger, your middle name becomes boy, however old you are, and your last name becomes John, and your wife and mother are never given the respected title Mrs., when you are harried by day and haunted by night by the fact that you are a Negro, living constantly at tiptoe stance, never quite knowing what to expect next, and are plagued with inner fears and outer resentments, when you are forever fighting a degrading and degenerating sense of nobodiness, then you will understand why we find it difficult to wait. There comes a time when the cup of endurance runs over and men are no longer willing to be plunged into the abyss of despair. I hope, sirs, you can understand our legitimate and unavoidable impatience.
That's Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. reading from his letter from Birmingham Jail. The full recording is at Stanford University's Martin Luther King Jr. Research and Education Institute. We've got a link to it at radioboston.org. Do yourself and your country a favor. Listen. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.